yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 060162, Donald Davis versus Fisk Electric Company, Fisk Technologies, and Fisk Management, Inc., from Harris County and the 14th Court of Appeals District. 060501, Juan Maria Viafani, M.D., versus Adela Trejo from Cameron County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. And 060502, Jan N. Ogletree, M.D., from Heart Hospital of Austin, versus Nancy K. Matthews and Luann Matthews from Travis County and the 3rd Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments, and the court will take a brief recess between them. We expect to complete all of them before noon. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 060162, Donald Davis versus Fisk Electric Company.
May it please the court. Ms. Jan will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Before Fisk ever saw a single member of the Vinar panel, before he asked a single question to any member of the Vinar panel, he held a firm conviction that African Americans should not serve on this case because it involved issues of race discrimination. And he stated in briefing to this court, admitting that fact. In his briefing to this court, particularly in his response to the petition for review, Fisk Electric stated that it held the belief that African Americans would respond with hostility towards it and would be peremptorily challenged. This is the essence of what Batson was enacted to forbid. Batson forbids a party from challenging potential jurors solely on account of their race or on the assumption that black jurors as a group will be unable impartially to consider the state's case against a black defendant.
I want to go back to the trial court proceeding and the way Judge Wildritz conducted this. My reading of the record, it appears to me that he conducted everything by the book in this hearing so that whatever challenges were made, they were done properly, procedurally.
I disagree, Justice Medina.
How so?
When the trial court considered the reasons that were advanced for the strikes, he was relying upon Perkett versus Ellum. And as the court now knows, Miller L versus Dredke has overruled Perkett's silly and superstitious standard for a Batson strike. Miller L specifically requires a common sense, best fit sort of approach to the reasons that are advanced for the strike. And it rejects the silly and superstitious standard. In fact, Miller L., unlike Perkett and Hernandez versus New York, is not a plurality opinion. It is a majority opinion authored by 6 justices of the Supreme Court. And it specifically requires that when a Batson strike is made and the reasons are offered for the strike, the reasons that are offered have to be plausible. And in
order, think they have to be verbal?
They have to be verbal.
Do you think they do, or can they be body language and demeanor?
They can be demeanor-related questions.
If the lawyer says that's what it was, how can we judge when we're just looking at a cold record?
Justice Hecht, I agree with you that in Yarbrough versus State, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals did resolve the conflict between the courts of appeals and hold that when you have the explanation that is given refers to a demeanor-related question and the person who's on the other side refuses to challenge it or is completely silent, then an assumption can be made that, in fact, the demeanor-related question did occur in the record because an appellate court has nothing else to review by.
So we can take the lawyer's word for it, you think?
Except, Your Honor, in this this specific case, there was an objection. On two specific occasions, I said the nonverbal conduct is not supported by the record. Now, the Court of Appeals said that when I used the word record, I was referring to a non-existent transcript. The Batson hearing, unlike a state criminal procedure, occurred contemporaneous with, as soon as the voir dire was concluded, we had the Batson hearing. There was no record. And I specifically referred to the nonverbal occurrences and said all the statements that have been made, because I didn't just have FIS lawyer providing nonverbal reasons. I had the trial judge adding his reasons, and none of those were supported by the record. And they were all fueled by the stereotypical belief that African Americans should not decide race discrimination cases. And that is very clear when you look at the two issues on which the Court of Appeals said, well, these are significant reasons. And that's
if the lawyer says, well, the potential juror was frowning at me the whole time, then we can take his word for it unless there's an objection. Is that your view of how we look at this procedurally?
In terms of not this case, but in a general issue of law, if a lawyer offers as a reason that the juror frowned, that is a reason that is provided. That does not mean that the trial judge abdicates his responsibility to see if that reason is pretextual, whether in fact that reason did occur.
Right, but the trial judge says, well, he either doesn't say anything or he says, I agree. Then where are we?
In this case, particularly, the trial judge did not conduct any kind of weighing of the evidence. He did not even attempt to determine whether the explanation that was being offered was, in fact, the best fit for the circumstances that were presented. And I'll give you a perfect example. If you look at the strike against Patrick Daigle, this was the employee who worked for Continental Airlines. The reference, the reason that was given was, Mr. Daigle was most clear when he said that, or when he reacted that punitive damages should be awarded against defendants. Now, if you look at this sentence in its entirety, no reasonable person can come to the conclusion that that was a reference to any sort of nonverbal gesture, nonverbal occurrence, which is what Yarbrough was designed to address. Now, unless FIS counsel is clairvoyant, how did he know why or how Mr. Daigle felt about punitive damages if he didn't speak a word?
Well, now, why isn't this ultimately left to the trial judge, who's there to control the court, has a lot of discretion on how these proceedings go forward as long as they follow certain parameters, such as Cortez? Ultimately, the trial judge has to make the decision based on what he or she views, either body language or verbal commitment or non-commitment, chance for rehabilitation. Why can't the trial judge ultimately make that decision?
He can, but in this case, he's still, and in all cases, he's still required, isn't he, to follow the law? He's still required
to... But it seems like he did to me, and I don't understand where he didn't, where your assertion is that there's some non-verbal response that the trial judge missed.
No, my assertion is not, Justice Medina, that there's a non-verbal response that he missed. But, for example, let's assume in this courtroom people laugh. And there is a reference to the fact that there is laughter. Can anybody before this court then come to the conclusion that the laughter is motivated by disbelief, by dislike? How can you attribute motivations to laughter? Laughter is a nonverbal occurrence, and counsel did say there was laughter. And the issue of laughter illustrates the limitations of the Yarbrough rule.
So nonverbal is not sufficient to show a neutral reason for the exercise of a peremptory strike?
No, not in and of itself, Chief Justice. I believe that you need to look at the record in its entirety. And clearly, if you look at Miller-El, that is exactly what the Supreme Court majority says.
But you mean if the veneer person is just sitting there frowning and shaking his head all during the examination, but he doesn't say a word, that's not enough? That surely is.
No. Justice Hecht, it is not enough because, for example, I am from India. We move our hands while talking, okay? African Americans may have certain cultural differences. Okay, for example, somebody might, when you're asking me a question, I frown because I'm thinking, if you interpret my frown as disrespect, sullenness, then you're making a judgment or a judgment.
But that's what peremptory challenges are about. You're not trying to prove, you're just trying to get a feel for.
But you still have to look at the question in its totality. You have to still consider the voir dire record in its totality. And what happened in this case is, if, for example, you're going to strike African Americans because they have a reaction to the word nigger, but you're not going to strike the Hispanic juror who was equally offended, the two Caucasian jurors who were equally offended, that is disparate treatment as a matter of law, and it's a violation of Title VII under which this case was brought. When 42 U.S.C. 1981A was passed, if you remember, it specifically added 2000EM, a subsection to the statute that says that when you have a good reason and a bad reason together in the same case, you still win. The plaintiff still wins because of that bad reason, even if he may not recover damages. And the courts have said that when you think about the word nigger, there is no other word in the English language that so segregates African Americans from everybody else. And yet, this trial judge said that could be a condition for excluding people from the jury. That surely cannot be the law of this land. In essence, what Fisk has been arguing throughout this case is, yes, there is the 14th Amendment, yes, there is the Equal Protection Clause, but race discrimination cases are an exception to the 14th Amendment Clause.
Look, and I can appreciate the concern of this whole scenario, because it certainly doesn't appear right. But the record, to me, doesn't indicate that anything was done wrong. And certainly the use of a particular word can be offensive to one group in a certain setting, but not in another setting, because the word you just used is a word that's constantly used in this rap music, and it's not offensive there. So I guess it depends on what the setting is to make the word offensive, whether it's that word or some other word, correct?
Justice Medina, did you say that it is used in rap music?
It's used in other type of environments. But having said that, is it the word or is it something else in the proceeding that's offensive?
Well, I don't believe what basketball players say on a basketball court or what Kanye West may say, who's a rapper in his music, sets our legal standards. Our legal standards still require that we apply the Equal Protection Clause to protect African Americans and people, women or men, gender-based strikes, national origin strikes. We protect these people from being struck because of their race.
Right, but so it's not the word then, it's something else,
well,
right?
It's the fact that that word, the reaction of that word is utilized as a basis to strike African Americans is a race-based strike as a matter of law. How can we say that here is a Hispanic juror who finds that word equally offensive, but we are going to retain that person on the jury? Here is a Caucasian juror who finds the word offensive. We are going to retain that person on the jury. But we are only going to strike African Americans from the jury. And here you have a defendant, a respondent, who is unequivocally telling you this is just common sense. It's just common sense to expect African Americans to lack that objectivity that we agree and recognize in every other race. But in this case, they completely lack objectivity because when presented with an issue of race discrimination, they're going to be so overwhelmed with bias and prejudice that they're simply not going to be able to make a decision.
I really struggle with distinguishing explanations that are perhaps unlikely versus those that are really laughably untrue or on their face implausible. Can you help us kind of draw a distinction between ones that we just think are more likely than not fictional or just unlikely versus those that are truly too incredible to merit belief?
I will illustrate that with an example from this case. Here you have a situation with respect to juror number 18 who was struck, who was Leon Randall. He was a janitor for Freeman Distributors. When both parties in this case and the judge asked the panel, does anybody know these lawyers? Does anybody know the parties? And if you recollect from the voir dire, nobody raised their hand. The reason that's offered to strike Mr. Randall by FIS counsel is, I got a judgment against Freeman Distributors, and I'm sure I'm very concerned about him being in this case. Why would a janitor even know about the existence of a judgment, and particularly when that reason that is offered, which is so laughable, the reason that's offered is, oh, he must be knowing about this judgment that I got. Well, if you look at the record in its totality, clearly nobody raised their hand to acknowledge that anybody knew any of the lawyers or the parties, but that is the reason that is offered, and the court buys that reason.
So at that point, you said the court botched that reason. Is that the point where the judge says, well, I don't believe you, therefore you're going to have to use a strike? I mean, the judge has to have some discretion on what he or she believes, correct?
Yes, the judge has to have discretion. But here, I believe...
How do we review that?
Well, Justice Medina, you review it by applying the law. And Miller L. versus Dredge gives you a roadmap. It says you do side-by-side juro comparisons.
The judge says that's not good enough. There's no way a janitor would have known that. Therefore, you lose on that cause.
No, Justice Medina. What the judge says is there is nothing in this record that indicates that Mr. Randall knew of either FISC or its counsel. And therefore, the reason that you have advanced is a false reason. It's a pretextual reason. 84.
That require more questioning by the judge, or does it end there?
Well, the Batson hearing was conducted after the voir dire was over, and certainly counsel had the opportunity and knew that he could, in fact, go in and separately question Mr. Randall. So if he truly believed, and I'll give him the benefit of doubt on this one and say, okay, let's assume that he believed that, in fact, he knew. The janitor, in fact, knew about the judgment. Why didn't he question him? He certainly was familiar with that process. He exercised that process to question Mary Hartz, who was a physical therapist, on an absolutely silly reason. Oh, she doesn't like lifting people, and I want to know if she likes her job. He then calls her in, and here is another example, Justice Willard, of a silly and superstitious reason. He says, I got a strike, Miss Hartz. You know, I went to law school, and when I did my law school voir dire, I was told whenever you question a person separately, you got to strike them, because they might think that, you know, I'm challenging them for cause. And going back to Justice Heck's question about nonverbal occurrences, is my time up?
Yes, your time is up.
I am so sorry. I didn't realize.
Are there further questions? Thank you.
You hold that thought and
thank you.
Hit on the bell.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Gray will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court. I have absolutely no idea why the conclusion that's presented to this court that we believed African Americans should be struck before this case ever started is the conclusion that the petitioner brings to you. That's just not the case.
Well, but it's easy to come to that conclusion if you look at the record and you understand what the underlying case is about and then come to the realization that all African Americans were struck. That's a pretty reasonable conclusion.
Well, it is true that five African Americans ended up being struck, but there was no one reason, not the answer to any one question, not the answer, not any one verbal or nonverbal reaction, why any of those prospective jurors were struck. In fact, they were struck in response to direct questions. And Randall would be a great place to start as an example for that. And I can talk as much as anybody would like about any of the particular jurors, and I know maybe the court has bigger policy questions in mind, but on Randall,
Before you go into that, let me ask you this. Does the fact that you asked for a jury shuffle at the beginning, does that affect the consideration of all this?
I think if the fair thing to say to you is everything affects the consideration of all of this. Yes, we asked for a jury shuffle. Now you should say, why did you ask for a jury shuffle? Answer, because if you looked at the makeup of the jurors, and in fact the Court of Appeals observed that the African-American prospective jurors were fairly equally dispersed throughout the entire panel. But what you see if you look carefully at the jury cards is that what we ended up being concerned about on the shuffle, and I have some specific, there were two attorneys in the back half. There was an engineer who was in the back half. There was a supervisor. There was a CPA. And there was an SBA loan officer who's a counselor to small businesses that ended up being, that were in the back half, that ended up being the very people that the petitioner used its peremptory challenges on. So it was the socioeconomic status, particularly we had in mind before this case, that the people who would be most likely to understand our client's position were employers, people who had supervisory.
All of those folks white?
Were the ones in the back? Yes. The petitioner did strike. All six of the people that the petitioner struck were Anglo.
So the shuffle wasn't to move the Afro-Americans back, but to move the whites up?
No. In fact, the racial makeup of the entire panel was equally dispersed. The shuffle was because of the occupations, primarily, of the people that were in the back half. And that is one of the questions that the court was looking at. And it's one of the things the court has to look at. But if you look at all the jurisprudence on Batson, and the Hernandez case is a great example of that, where they say the decision on the Batson challenge is akin to a fact-finding by the trial judge, who is uniquely, particularly within his purview, to see that, sit there and watch the reactions of the prospective jurors, see exactly what we're talking about vis-a-vis the disbursement of the prospective jurors in the courtroom, and that decision by the trial judge is akin to a fact-finding that's entitled to great deference. And that's the way it almost has to be in order for there to be any practical way for the courts to review the issue.
Well, certainly it's entitled to great deference, but then you have a case like Miller L., where that trial court would be entitled to great deference, and the Supreme Court, in a majority opinion, said that the peremptory challenges were not neutrally exercised. So what standard should we use to determine whether the trial court's discretion was abused?
Well, in the federal court side, and what it says in Hernandez is it's clearly erroneous standard. And so, of course, here it's an abuse of discretion, or that's the way we would articulate it. But that's how significant the fact-finding is. Miller L., as I recall the case, was tried before Batson. And it was the case where the Dallas County District Attorney's Office had a playbook that said, we're going to shuffle if there's a disproportionate number of African Americans in the front of the voir dire panel. And so what the court says in Miller L. is that happenstance didn't explain why the things that happened in Miller L. happened, and once again reaffirms we're going to look at everything that happened in the course of the case in order to make a determination. And Miller L. does nothing to disturb the notion that it's the trial court's judgment call when a Batson challenge is asserted.
But when there is a claim of racial discrimination and the claimant is African American, and the part of the claim is that language was used which would be offensive, hopefully to most anybody, but at least certainly to an African American. And five of the six strikes are of African Americans in the veneer. It just seems almost to stretch credulity too far to think that there wasn't some racial thinking in that process.
And so what we would submit is you have to look at the entirety of the voir dire and the fact that no one person was struck for any one reason. Mr. Randall, I started talking about that a little while ago. Mr. Randall, what I said was, I know a lot about his employer. I never suggested or meant to suggest that I thought Mr. Randall knew something about the fact I had tried a case against his employer in the past. In fact, I was quite certain Mr. Randall had no idea about that. But I knew enough about his employer to know that he was a custodian in a meatpacking plant. We had a very nuanced case. We had a situation where our client could have made the decision for this discharge on a false notion. What the decision makers were told was that the petitioner was responsible for what the Court of Appeals accurately described as a debacle on this job, and the petitioner was blamed for it. It was possible that the petitioner was blamed wrongfully. That was one of the positions the petitioner was going to take, and yet our decision makers acted on that information. That would not make it race motivated. And similarly, as the court's probably aware, the shifting burdens in a race discrimination case. So we, going in, knew that we wanted jurors who were demonstrably intelligent. Give me 12 intelligent jurors, and I've convinced myself I'm going to be able to convince them of the merits of my client's cause, or I'm not going to try the case, I'm going to settle the case. And in that particular instance, I'm standing in the ceremonial courtroom at the Harris County District Court with 50 prospective jurors out in the hallway, and I'm supposed to tell Judge Wooldridge that that guy's not very smart. And probably if I had a do-over, I'd have said, look, there's no way to conclude he's intelligent enough to sit on this jury panel. Not just because of the way he filled out his juror information card, not just because of the fact he's an employee and a custodian in a meatpacking plant. On top of that, with that particular instance, there was Mr. Randall specifically said that he had been discriminated against in employment-related issues in the past.
Mr. Gray, let me just ask you, I know you've offered some other reasons for striking the jurors in this case, but presume with me, if you will, that there were 10 African-Americans on the panel, on the venire, and in this case, all 10 exhibited a very negative bodily reaction to the racial slur that was used in this case. Would that alone be sufficient to support a peremptory strike, or do you acknowledge that it would not?
I would refer the court back to all of the Batson jurisprudence that says you've got to look at it, the totality of the circumstances.
But if that were the only evidence we had, that there was a clear reaction that no other jurors had, that only the African-American jurors had, would that be a permissible Batson strike?
If it was the only evidence the court had, it would have to have much more weight, be given much more weight than it would in a circumstance like that presented here.
But I guess that's what gets me to the troubling feature of this case, is in that instance, it seems like clearly the motivation is racial. It's racially motivated strike. There's an emotional reaction that in the typical case would allow a strike, but in that instance, it seems as though it would be racially motivated. And I'm trying to figure out how we would parse out those two.
You would need to look at all the circumstances. You would need to look at a situation like Mr. Daigle, who petitioner brought up in her argument. Mr. Daigle was somebody that on paper looked to me like he would be a good juror for our client, somebody who could understand our client's position. And yet, arguably, what Mr. Daigle said was that Continental Airlines engages in pervasive discriminatory employment practices, so much so that they have to have committees that referee disputes between the company and employees, including racial discrimination. And what, after hearing Mr. Daigle say that, I concluded, well, he has in his mind that it's even possible that Continental Airlines engages in racially discriminatory employment practices. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But what I believed in exercising peremptory challenges, there are plenty of people who don't think that about Continental Airlines, and I shouldn't have to have one of those on my jury as opposed to somebody who does think that.
So by chance, it was 5 of the 6 Venire members who happened to be African-American who caused you a concern because they made some statement or some overtures about employment discrimination, or was it some other?
Well, I asked the question about whether anybody had suffered the sting of discrimination with the intention of following up on that to find out whether it was employment-related. And interestingly, in Mr. Daigle's circumstance, he said yes. He had been the highest-paid employee in a specific position at a company, and that he had been removed from that position because he was black. That's what he said in the board hire.
Do you have any statistics as to whether or not minorities suffer more race discrimination or pursue more race discrimination than non-minorities?
No, and in fact, I think the whole petitioner's case is built on a false premise that only minorities, African Americans, are offended by racism. I think that the notion that only African Americans or only minorities are offended by racism is wrong, and that when you ask a question like whether people are offended by the use of a racial slur, it's wrong to say that only minorities are going to express offense. In this particular case, 2 of the 3 people who raised their hand and said, I have a real big problem with that, did so in the context of everybody's got a problem with it. We all know it's inappropriate. And yes, there were 2 or 3 jurors who said, I agree it's inappropriate, it's problematic, it's not proper. And after that, the question's asked, so, does anybody, based on everything you've heard so far, feel like they may have a hard time listening to the facts in this case? And three people raised their hand. Two of them were African American. One of them was Hispanic. And they said, yes, I have a real hard time with that. Or, yes, that's a really big deal. And so those two of the strikes were exercised on those people.
And yet number nine, juror number nine, said, I also feel the same way. And we all know that words are preceded by thoughts. So even before he said it, those thoughts were there. And that was not a juror that was subject to a peremptory challenge.
I'm thinking the reference to number nine is Edmund. Edmund was number nine, I believe, if my notes are correct. And, yes, Edmund was one of the people challenged. The one who said, we all know words are preceded by thoughts, was named Renaga. Her name was Clara Renaga. And she was a Hispanic prospective.
Who agreed with number nine about the strength of her feelings against the use of that word.
She did. And that was the only thing that happened during the entire voir dire that would have made Ms. Renaga objectionable. And if I had seven strikes, Ms. Renaga probably would have been the seventh strike, but I only had six. And I'm trying to weigh all of the issues, including the fact that you have somebody nodding their head. Absolutely, I agree with the use of punitive damages in a case like this.
Let me ask you this about body language. It's very hard for the record to demonstrate, you know, that a particular juror rolled his eyes or had a frown on his or her face. If that alone is enough to justify a strike, then what's left of Batson, really?
Well, clearly it is. I mean, in fact, that's exactly what happened in the Hernandez case I referenced a little while ago. It's a 1991 United States Supreme Court case. A prosecutor says, I know he said that he would just listen to the translator, but I didn't believe him because of his body language. And the Supreme Court of the United States accepted that. And I think that opinion and the concurrence by Justice O'Connor are both pretty.
We'll never have another case like this. Once we say body language is enough, someone roll their eyes and the case is over.
I don't agree that. I do see where body language can be problematic in the overall setting. In this particular instance, well, let me just back up and say, as a bigger policy matter, when somebody says body language, now it becomes incumbent upon the petitioner in this case, the party who's asserting the Batson objection, to say, I didn't see any body language, and even I could have been sworn in to testify. She could have cross-examined me on what body language I saw that I was objecting to in order to make a more clear record. And it's in the context of me having to get up there and say body language, knowing full well that the trial court watched the entire voir dire.
So let me ask one other point. You say that the trial court's finding must be given great deference, and I think the cases stand for that proposition. But are we to review what the trial court heard as your defense to the use of the peremptory strikes, or is it our job to look at the entire record and determine whether there are other neutral reasons?
I think the totality of the circumstances can be considered by the trial court.
So it's not just your explanation, but everything else that's in the record?
A perfect example is Mr. Randall's handling of his juror information card.
The reason I ask that is because at the Batson hearing, you make certain statements about why you exercise a peremptory strike, and they were limited to those statements at the hearing. And then on appeal, in the brief on the merits, there's a much more extended defense of those peremptory strikes.
And I would argue that they were more in the nature of clarification, but as an example on Ms. Edmund, before I even got finished giving my explanation, the trial court jumped in and said, you know, there were about five different reasons why somebody would strike Ms. Edmund, and I've heard enough. And once the trial court does that, now the burden shifts back to the party asserting the Batson objection to more fully develop the record. So once I've said enough that the trial judge believed, in the trial judge's discretion, was credible about why we'd exercise peremptory challenge and that it didn't have anything to do with race, then the burden shifts back there and the record should be more fully developed. But in terms of reviewing this, I mean, there have been cases where parties have urged courts to look at the appellate record and make it what is basically a de novo review. I think there's some phrase that they use, appellate review in the first instance or something along those lines. Well,
you also mentioned the sting of discrimination in the past. Do you think it would be appropriate to exclude all jurors who believe they have been subject to racial discrimination?
Not necessarily. I think it depends on other circumstances. In this case, it was an employment-related case, so the next question is, was it in connection with your employment? And then the next questions are intended to follow up and find out if they are particularly hostile to our client's point of view, not for the purpose necessarily of challenges for cause.
Could you exclude all jurors who have been subject to racial discrimination in employment with a peremptory challenge?
Once again, I'm going to say the totality of the circumstances. It possibly you could, and in some circumstances you might not be able to.
There's a whole category of cases of plaintiffs or of citizens in the United States who are subject to racial discrimination during a period in our nation's history that to this day are potential jurors. Would they be subject to peremptory challenges on that basis?
In most instances, I would say probably not. I think I should say, and attack this sort of disparate questioning argument that's been presented, although it hasn't been discussed, head on, and just say, you know, the rules say there's broad latitude in the questions that are going to be asked. But if I was fashioning an opinion in this case, my concern would be, were our questions directly related to either the subject matter of the trial that was on trial, or to particular facts that were likely to come up? We didn't introduce the N-word in this case. In fact, petitioner's counsel in voir dire said there's going to be evidence that the N-word was used. And under those circumstances, our questions about it were particularly related to the facts. So does a question relate to the subject matter on trial? Does a question relate to the facts that are on trial? Then the question should be something that counsel can inquire into.
But certainly a good lawyer such as yourself can work around that and ask the questions that pertain to the specific subject matter and the specific facts to skirt around the Batson rules.
Well, and arguably that's right. And once again, the question should be on the burdens on the trial court's shoulders to find out why the lawyer is asking questions the way the lawyer is asking them, and why the lawyer is exercising peremptory challenges the way the lawyer is exercising the peremptory challenges.
But part of your explanation for striking some of these jurors is that they had a strong feeling on the subject of the N-word. That was part of the defense that you gave in front of the trial court. Why would we ever want a juror in a racial discrimination case that is not disturbed by the use of a racial epithet?
We wouldn't, and nobody.
No matter the juror's race,
and nobody was struck just because they disagreed. They thought that it was improper.
But that was one of your explanations of a neutral reason for the exercise of the strike.
Okay. Answer the question.
You may answer.
Thank you. But those particular jurors said it's a real big problem for me, in the context of everybody already having agreed it's inappropriate.
You mentioned before that you believed all people should have a reaction to an alleged offensive racial act or statement, not just minority jurors, potential jurors, right?
Yes.
If that's the case, then talking about gestures, then every member of the panel, you would expect to have some type of response, facial or otherwise, to such an alleged obnoxious racial statement. And those that didn't would be unusual.
Yes, and they would be struck, and in this case were.
So then, to strike the ones that frowned upon referring to such a statement to a panel, how probative can that gesture be if you would expect all the people to have a similar uncommon reaction to such an alleged statement?
In your specific scenario, it wouldn't be probative, but that's not what happened here. But I agree with you. If that was all there was, it wouldn't be enough.
You agree that in the Batson hearing, counsel at least has to state what the gestures were?
I think the counsel has to convince the court that the reasons were race neutral, for exercising the peremptory challenge.
Specifically with regard to gestures, should counsel have to say what the gestures were that led counsel to that conclusion, whatever it is?
The counsel should be able to, and if cross-examined, if asked about it specifically, what gestures are you talking about, the counsel would have to be able to do it in a credible way.
Only if objected, if there's an objection and then he's challenged on it, or should counsel have to say what the gestures are if that's the basis for peremptory when you're in a Batson hearing?
I do think it requires an objection. I think it has to have some, there has to be some reason for counsel to make that record. We can't, it would take too long to try these cases and certainly to do voir dire. If counsel is supposed to make a record to go down every rabbit trail that nobody else is questioning, if somebody's laughing out loud cynically, which is what happened here, then the trial judge saw it, the trial judge noted it too, enough said. If somebody says, I didn't see that, I want to hear more about it, there needs to be an explanation from the
court. It wouldn't happen that much. Batson hearings are very rare.
Well, in the context of our civil cases, true. In the context of criminal cases, apparently not.
Further questions? Thank you, counsel.
I want to take up on the issue of jury shuffle. There were 50 people on the Vinar panel. There were 7 African-American jurors in the front of the panel. After it was shuffled, there were only 6. So arguably, at least there would have been one more juror on this panel if they hadn't been shuffled. Second, if you look at the references to Hernandez and Porquette, I'm not sure Hernandez and Porquette survive Miller L. versus Dredge. I think it's pretty evident, and there are a host of law review articles and opinions that have come out, including in the Fifth Circuit, that recognize that Miller L. has totally changed the landscape. Third, the explanation that is given for making the strike stands and falls on what counsel offers. It is not up to the trial judge or the appellate court to come in and supply reasons. So,
but we would have to find that counsel's explanation was pretextual as a matter of law.
Yes.
And that's a very difficult thing to do when the trial court is listening to the arguments and able to observe the panel himself.
I agree, Justice O'Neill, that it is. You need to find that it is pretextual as a matter of law. But here you have counsel admitting that if you strike somebody only because of the fact that they react to the N-word or they react to the fact that they've suffered, quote-unquote, the sting of discrimination, that would be pretextual. And here you have counsel admitting during voir dire, specifically after Mr. Pickett.
Well, but I don't think that there are any jurors that were struck that there wasn't an additional explanation offered for.
Yes. But the additional explanation was insignificant, and the Court of Appeals notes that. In the Court of Appeals opinion, the Court of Appeals recognizes that the significant reason for the strike was the fact of the reaction to the N-word and the examples of race discrimination, that they had experienced race discrimination. And as the majority opinion in Miller L. says, just because you can come up with some other silly or superstitious reasons doesn't mean that the pretextual significance of the reason that is given simply disappears.
Let's just, you know, get away from the silly and other language that's in that case, but talk about here where you have a lawyer who's able to tie in the responses to the facts of his case to find another reason to strike. Help me with a test to decide whether or not that's correct or that's wrong, keeping in mind that the trial court has to have some discretion here, some broad discretion in making these decisions on what he or she views to be inappropriate behavior or response to a particular word or comment.
Justice Medina, I recognize, I've tried these cases for 6 years on the defense side. I recognize that in race discrimination cases, there are issues that come up, and you need to be able to examine the panel about it. But if you look at the voir dire, there was little to no interest in examining the Vinar panel with respect to their views. Take the example of Mr. Pickett. All that was asked of him was, did you suffer race discrimination? And just based upon his answer, yes, there is an assumption, this giant leap of logic made, that he suffered the exact same injury as Mr. Davis. Where are the facts to back it up? I would agree if one of these Vinar people had said, I was terminated, I was denied a promotion because of my race. Something that could lead a reasonable person to conclude that the injury was...
Of course, peremptory challenges are based on more of a feeling than... Even if the person says, oh, no, I'd be a fair juror, lawyers strike them all the time anyway, right?
Yes, and that is why...
So now let me ask you if your client was suing for age discrimination and you struck, the defendant struck all the senior citizens, that'd be okay?
No, it would not be okay. Would be okay in terms of Batson because it hasn't been extended.
Nobody's ever applied Batson to age.
That's correct.
So because they're old people are more likely to, senior citizens more likely to relate to your client, strike them all, but because it's race, you can't, and the difference in the two cases is because the Constitution requires it.
Yes, because the 14th Amendment requires it.
And so why wouldn't we be better off? Obviously, that's allowing you to get a more favorable jury in one kind of discrimination claim than another. Wouldn't the best way to make them even is just to have no peremptory strikes in those cases?
Well, yes, if you adopt Justice Breyer's concurring opinions across the board, including the case.
As long as we've got six peremptories, some of the most in the country, those cases are going to be skewed.
There is going to be an inherent tension because peremptory challenges are exercised for discretionary reasons, and they may be exercised for reasons that are not, you know, that may infer discrimination, and that's where the trial judge comes in. And I want to go back to what the amicus has said in this case. It is difficult enough for minority jurors to serve on juries. And if we enact these rules and interpret laws to exclude them, then they are not going to be participants in civic life.
Other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.